Welcome to the Empirical Cycling Podcast. I'm your host, Coley Moore, joined as always by my co-host, Kyle Helson. Thank you, everybody, for listening as always. And of course, if you're new here, please subscribe to the podcast. And if you like what you're hearing, please share the podcast, especially if you're a returning listener. That goes the biggest way towards helping out the podcast if that's what you want to do. You can also give us a nice rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We appreciate all of those. And we are ad-free, so if you'd like to donate and support the show that way, your donations go a very long way and keep the lights on here. You can do so at empiricalcycling.com/donate. We've got all the show notes up on the website. We may not have any today because it's a 10-minute tips episode, which means we literally spent 10 minutes preparing. So sorry about that. We will have some Wattstock episodes coming up. I'm doing a lot of research on that stuff. And if you have any coaching or consultation inquiries, if you want to answer any of your own questions or have us answer any of your own questions, you can hire us for a consultation. We're happy to sit down and have a chat and we could look over your files. We could look at what went right and wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And if you'd like a coach and you want to just forget all that, please reach out for that kind of stuff too. Empiricalcycling@gmail.com is where you should reach out. And we've got some listener questions today from my Instagram at empiricalcycling. So if you would like to ask a question for the podcast or just my weekend AMAs, which I do every Saturday, Sunday, just head over there and give me a follow and watch in the stories. So one of the things that I wanted to do today, kind of as a stopgap, because I had a Wattstock episode almost ready, and then I found a new, like, you know, trove of papers from like a new review paper I found, and I went, oh, I got a lot more work to do. Yeah, I know. It's typical science, right, Kyle?
Yeah. No, I mean, it happens, especially if you're not, I feel like it's actually worse probably, in like medicine and sports fit, stuff like that, just because way more people, way more journals, things to look after, than in physics. So it's impossible sometimes to stay on top of absolutely everything, unless that's your job, just to pull literature and, you know, have a subscription to every journal.
Yeah.
And then you're screwed if it's not, and also if it's not current and you're just like, do you just search PubMed every day and like,
right,
have a checklist?
Yeah. I mean, I know of at least three people who have one to three assistants who do nothing but comb through literature to send them things to read. Like,
yeah.
which is insane sounding to me. And I'm at this point, I'm like, I wish I had somebody like that. And people send me papers, but a lot of the time it's like, you know, popular stuff that I'm going to see probably anyway. And it's like, I would really, especially when I start going down a rabbit hole, because for the next Wattstock, we're going to be talking about calcium signaling, and there's a lot in there, like a lot in there. And I was trying to find like a couple good studies, because we've kind of talked about it on the podcast already, and we'll get into this in the next probably the next podcast where we do the Wattstock. But it was one of those things where it made me start thinking of all the ways that you could big brain this kind of stuff. And I mean big brain in the sarcastic way, where you think you're like, you know, biohacking or something.
Check out the big brains on Brad.
And it turns out that it's actually not really working the way you think. It's like if you over-focus on one signal or one parameter, you actually miss the forest for the trees. And so it made me start thinking about FTP and VO2 max training. And because in a lot of the podcast episodes that we've done, we haven't really gone too deep into really kind of the programming periodization and the kind of purposes, and also like that you don't have to do it a certain way. And I think that's something that I didn't really expect. Like when we did the VO2 max podcast episodes and I was talking about doing blocks and shortening intervals and all that kind of stuff, that's like a middle ground approach. And it's not the only thing that works. And so I wanted to spend today going over a couple of my bonus thoughts on all of that kind of stuff, especially after having done a lot of consultations for people over the years. And we'll talk about some of the big mistakes I've seen in a lot of those. We'll also get into kind of different ways to do stuff. And then we're going to answer a lot of listener questions, because I asked up on the Instagram yesterday on Friday, and boy, did we get questions. I think we got about 40 or 50. We're not going to answer all of them, of course, but we're going to answer the good ones, the ones that I think will lead to the most useful advice. It's been kind of shocking to me how people have either interpreted really well or even misinterpreted a lot of the recommendations that we've put out there. But I mean, it's one of those things that's like, shouldn't be surprising to me. I mean, maybe I'm just super naive about this stuff. I mean, I know, forget it, Jake, it's the internet, right? Like,
yeah. Well, I think the other thing too is like depending on what someone is looking for, you know, if they want a prescription or something like that. So they maybe try to force it or like shoehorn it or try to synthesize it with other things they've learned elsewhere. And sometimes, you know, you can end up kind of, yeah, like you said, kind of big braining it because you think, oh, I'm going to take this from this and this from this and then going to like mix it all up. And this is what I came up with. And like, what do you think of that? And you're like, a separate, different person would not have put that together in the same way because you're not that person with that same background, knowledge, same experience, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's, why don't we just start with, some Vitamax stuff? Cause I think this was the one where I see a lot of people asking about blocks. I'm going to do a Vitamax block. And my first thought is, okay, cool. But also at the same time, here's something is when I think about blocking up like VO2max or FTP or whatever it is, usually the reason for that is because it's easy to control the inputs and outputs. Like, you know what stimulus you're giving the athlete, and so you know exactly what you should expect on the other side. I mean, that's basic variable control for science, right?
Right.
So when I give somebody a VO2max block, first I need to make sure they're prepared for it. And one of the things that I like to see for somebody to be prepared for it is I like to see, well, it depends. Oh God. I was going to say something and I thought, nope, it depends. Oh God. I did it to myself. I'm sorry. Preparing for it, I need to know that somebody is basically aerobically as about as good as they've been in the past, if we're going to use it to raise FTP for the future. I think that's the biggest thing here about being prepared for VO2max block, where, you know, because VO2max is the ceiling on FTP. So if you want to raise your FTP, you have to raise your VO2max. Like, they kind of go hand in hand. And so in order to push you past where you had been, you have to be where you've been. And I like to get there when possible with low intensity training. Because, well, if you just get off the couch, anything is going to make you better. I think we've talked about this in the podcast before, right? Where, like, you get all the noob gains, but if it's all high intensity, you've now accumulated a ton of fatigue.
Yeah.
And now you've got to like rest and recover before you do more high intensity. And at some point that's going to wear on a person. So
you mean you can't do like VO2max, hard VO2max every day for 12 weeks or whatever that
is. Oh God. I think, oh yeah. The dysfunctional mitochondria episode. I think, yeah. What was that? Watchdog 41 or two? I think it was 41. That was a fun episode. And by fun, I mean, there was a lot of, oh God, they did what? if you haven't heard it. So once you are ready for a VO2max block, doing it, you should on the other side see an FTP improvement. But like I said, this is not the only way to do it. I've certainly had clients and our coaches have certainly had clients where doing a focused block isn't working. Either the workouts are like poor quality, somebody's not motivated to do it, or we've got our own proprietary ways of seeing if it's working or not, probably more quickly than most people would be able to tell, I think. And when that happens, one of the things that I usually suggest is doing what I call a mixed block, where you do one VO2max workout and one threshold workout per week. Maybe you want to do 2 and 1 or 1 and 2. It doesn't really matter if you're doing 3 hard workouts, but that's a good place to start if you're not seeing much improvements doing just one or just the other. And that's why I also recommend just two hard workouts per week, so you've got plenty of recovery time, because the recovery may be part of it as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like if you're just barely recovering enough to like make it to the next hard workout, you're maybe doing a little too much. You know, like even if you think like, oh, you know, I have to accumulate fatigue and I should be tired and I should be overreaching. Those are all true. But if you're like just barely making it by, or like, you know, Monday you feel great and then Tuesday you feel less good, and then by Friday you're like, I can't believe I have to do a workout today. You know, you're like, maybe it's a touch too much.
Yeah.
And then, so you're not going to see those improvements as quickly because you're just tired. You know, like you may have it potentiated if you rest up the ability to set a new FTP or new TT or whatever, but you're just so tired, you're never going to see it. And then you're going to get discouraged. And then hopefully you're not going to double down, which people do.
Frequently, very frequently. Like I've consulted with a lot of people, and the number of people who have doubled down, like we'll you know, do a consult, we'll have a conversation, and then they'll say, hey, could you check in Training Peaks real quick? To make sure that the plan that I've written out is kind of along the lines of what we discussed. And most of the time it's great. Now, every once in a while I'm like, oh yeah, you did the, you know, once is good, twice is better, eight times is better. Yeah. And there, because I think what sometimes people forget is there's diminishing returns as you stack workouts and accumulate fatigue. And so if you're just looking at workouts as like pass fail, I'm just going to do 2x20 sweet spot, and that's going to be a hard workout. Like, okay, first, that should not be a hard workout for anybody. Unless you are like literally just off like the world's best race block, and your body is like, okay, I'm cooked. Let me rest. And second, if you pass fail workouts, by like power values without using any other metrics like RPE, heart rate, or, you know, anything else, you're not guaranteed to have a bad time, but it's not like you're guaranteed to have a good time. And that's kind of my big concern is always, I want to set people up to have a good time, right?
Yeah, you should be enjoying it hypothetically. It shouldn't yeah. just be dreading.
Yeah. So let's talk about recovery, because, you know, kind of like we just said, when you are thinking of recovery in block is very, very important. And this is one of the things that a lot of people would benefit from, is stacking workouts close to each other, where you might would do like two or three harder workouts in a row, like, you know, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, long ride, easy ride, Sunday, then you recover Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's a pretty good way to do it. If you're thinking, I can do this number of workouts, but again, like that's not like the only way to do it. There's a lot of ways that you can manipulate these variables, and finding out what works for you. And this is, by the way, why I'm not as popular as a lot of other silver bullet coaches, and because there's no right answer to any of this. There's also no wrong answer per se, but there is a right and a wrong answer for an individual. Oh, speaking of recovery after a block. And I think this is like the number one thing that I see people trying to overdo, is overdoing the number of workouts they can fit in and underdoing the recovery. So here's, and I'm sorry for those of you who are listening who are like, oh, I'm doing this. If if you do 3 weeks of VO2 max work, and like, let's say you finish your last VO2 max workout on like a Thursday or a Friday for that 3 week block. You take the weekend, spend some time with your family, chill out, have a beer, take a nap, whatever. But you do your first FTP block workout on Tuesday or Wednesday, you have probably not given yourself near enough recovery.
Yeah, you would like, that's like 3 days, 4 days, 3 yeah. days.
Yeah.
Like that makes sense. If you're thinking like, oh, I'm going to string these two things together and maybe take like a fuller longer week off later. But yeah, if that's your, this, my recovery week is 3.5 days. Like,
yeah,
is it?
Well, I mean, it's not even a week. Like, it's a recovery week for a reason. Like, Okay, as for some people who recover fast and where the training load isn't quite that high or that intense, like, yeah, sure, like we can get away with 5 days easy, where day six or day seven is back to hard work again. But for a lot of people, after a VO2 max block, especially if you haven't done one before, it can take, and actually the harder the VO2 max block is, for most people, the longer it takes to fully realize all the benefits that you gathered from it. So from this season, 2023 season, a lot of my athletes went through a hard VO2 max block. And for some of them, it was their first time doing something like this. And for a lot of them, it was not. The average full recovery time where we saw the full FTP improvements after the block was anywhere from 2 to 6 to 8 weeks.
Jesus.
Yeah. So there's a couple ways to look at recovery from this. So the first way to check is to recover for a while, wait till your legs just feel good. And if it takes, you know, a week, a little over a week, okay, that's fine. Like do some endurance riding, do some easy riding. Make sure you're recovering and starting to feel good. Now go do a 3 to 5 minute test or whatever your typical range is. Some people it's 4, some people it's 6, whatever you got in that VO2 max type range. Go do a test. A lot of the time, I would say it's 50-50, maybe 40-60, where people will do the same power that they did before the block, but they will have a lot of residual feelings of fatigue. It's very, very common. That doesn't mean that the block didn't work. It's that you are still tired from your block and you need more recovery. And so my recommendation is to either take a couple extra easy days and then start on your next phase, which would either be like, you know, FTP kind of extend TTE kind of stuff, or you would want to, maybe it's time to get ready to race. So you'd want to start doing your race prep intervals and doing, you know, all that kind of stuff. So as you recover from that and you are recovering, hopefully in block from these hard workouts, because a hard workout might take 2, 3, 4 days to really be able to do another hard one, you will hopefully see at some point your FTP improvements happening. And this is, it's easy to gauge by RPE, but you can also do any number of tests that you want. So yeah, it can take a long time to really recover from a block. And the harder and longer the block is, the longer the recovery. And even if I like short somebody a block, somebody's like, oh, I want to do 3 weeks and I'm at like week 2, 2.5. I'm like, I think we need to call it right now. Because I don't know how you're going to react on the other side of it, even though the block looks like it's working really well, it can really take a couple extra weeks to really see the full benefits and get the full recovery. I mean, but in the mitochondrial dysfunction episode, we kind of saw that, where there was a certain type of like mitochondrial biogenesis, but there was also a certain lag in some of the other markers of like oxidative enzymes and such. So it wouldn't surprise me if something similar was happening in this. Obviously, it hasn't been studied, but something similar wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. You figure, too, like, it's one thing, like, kind of like you said, if you're getting off, like, an endurance block or, like, a sweet spot block, like, not nearly as much intensity, like, those workouts, you're not really getting to the end and, like, white-knuckling them, whereas you just think, like, the end of a hard VO2 max workout, you're digging pretty deep, right? Like that, mm-hmm. like just based sheer on, even though the time is less, I understand it's less total time or whatever, but it's not like a linear thing where like, oh, like we've said before, like, you know, 10 minutes at a certain power, you know, 5 minutes at twice that power is not necessarily like just twice as hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Like, actually that reminds me, one of the things I wanted to discuss is actually doing the efforts themselves. So there's a couple things that I get a lot of questions on. The first one is, do you actually need to start hard? And the answer is, well, everybody say it with me. It depends. So for a lot of people, actually, I find usually the good sprinters need to start less hard. And well, obviously the big reason is that you can really blow your legs out of the water on the first effort if you really go for it.
you just send one and you're like, well, won't make it the next 2 minutes of this 4 minute interval. Like, just not gonna make it.
Yeah. And then you take a rest that's like 3 or 4 times as long as planned before the next effort, and then you can't even fart out a good one because the first one was so hard. Okay, yeah, all right. Now we've burned off some of that freshness. Hopefully tomorrow's workout goes better. But yeah, so not starting quite so hard, especially early on while you're fresh, but also as fatigue mounts through the block, it's easier to not start so hard and just kind of like by, you know, if you're at workout like 6 or something like that, you're probably able to kind of gauge, I'm going to start this hard and this is going to be about as hard as I can go evenly for a whole, whatever, 3 minutes. And that's not a bad way to do it. Because one of the things that I said, I think I said, it's been a while, in that podcast was, you've got to be breathing really, really hard when you're doing VO2 max efforts. And I find actually for steady state efforts, this is true, because it becomes a good, because, you know, breathing, it's not an indicator necessarily of O2 consumption, but it's definitely the mechanism is based on the CO2 production. And so it's not always the best indicator, especially if you're doing like 30-30s or something like that, or just high intensity interval training, which obviously if you're new, high intensity interval training, you do a 30-second effort, you're not going to be breathing that hard until after the effort's done. And yet there's a lot of good VO2 max adaptation with that kind of stuff. So it's not always a good indicator, but for steady state stuff, it tends to be a good indicator, even though it's not a direct indicator. So as long as you're getting up there, that's fine. That's my recommendation anyway. That's not the only way to check. But the other thing with the adjusting for the fatigue that you accumulate if you are doing a block is going to be, I'd originally said you want to reduce the interval time. So you want to start with like 5 or 6 minutes. You want to reduce it down to like a 2 minute interval. And that's a way of dealing with fatigue, but you want to keep about 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes interval time total in the workout. But if you are somebody who just does not feel comfortable doing a 5 minute interval, that's fine. Do 2, do 3. Find a range that works for you is the point here. Not like I feel like I have to do 5 minute intervals, because if you do a bunch of 2 minute intervals, honestly, you're probably going to get this about the same benefit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, kind of like we said before, there's more than one way to go about accumulating that time in roughly total time at that intensity, right? Like, obviously, if you're doing them in, I don't know, 30-second blocks, okay, that's a little too extreme. There is a range in there, a flexibility to dice it up, right? And obviously, one 20-minute interval is not. So that's the extreme at one end, and, you know, a bunch of 20-second intervals is the extreme at the other, and neither of those. But if you're away from those edges...
Oh, yeah, minimum interval durations. Well, that's harder to say. I would say 2 minutes is about the minimum that you want to do. And the last question is high cadence. Do you absolutely have to do high cadence? And the answer is actually no. But if you are doing a block, I recommend it, because if nothing else, even if you don't care about the, you know, muscle pump mechanism and all that stuff, it'll save the muscular fatigue on the legs and keep most of the aerobic benefits, or actually improve them to some degree. So especially if you're going to do like a double day, if you get up in the morning, you do, 2 hour ride, if you do 4x5 minutes, and if you're planning on doing something in the evening, high cadence is my strong recommendation. You will be surprised about how good it feels, as long as you are getting enough to eat and you're recovering in between enough. Like if you go out and you run a 10K in between, you're probably not going to have a good evening workout.
So, is that oddly specific? Has someone done this before?
I don't want to dox anybody, so no comment. So how do we know if the FTP block was effective? Is probably the last question to address here. Is your FTP went up? But like I said, you may not see that immediately because of acute fatigue. So I suggest you can work at your previous FTP if that's feeling fine. And hopefully you're not overdoing it to the point where you can't actually recover doing the block. And after 4, 6, 8 weeks, you should be feeling better. And maybe you want to go out and do like we did another FTP, like a second FTP testing redux episode. And, I forget which 10 minute tips that was. It might've been like 12 or 15 or something. But I think I pretty much said you want to go out and just like give a 30 minute effort, like a TT effort. Because sometimes
like feel it out.
Yeah.
Feel out your,
well, cause sometimes you wear the rut in your RPE, or even like mentally you see that number and you think, oh, if I go harder than this number, it feels harder. Cause you think it's harder cause it's a bigger number.
Bigger is always better, right?
I mean, I've had that problem myself. That's how I know it's a thing. So going out and when you're fresh, you can't like do 4 workouts and then go, okay, tomorrow I just did 4 hard workouts in a row. Now tomorrow I'm going to go do a 30 minute effort. It doesn't usually work like that. If you're like off the couch, super fresh, maybe an exception, but, anyway, so that's VO2 max stuff. And I think the biggest thing about it is that if you don't have the time or energy to do a dedicated block, you don't have to. I've definitely got clients where we do it when we can. If they've got a busy race season, or if they're like dieting, or if, if they're injured and we don't really have a chance to do it, or they don't have enough runway to recover afterwards, like they've got races they have to be in shape for, we don't do a dedicated block because there's no way. Like, why would you do that if you're like, I've got a race that I need to be in really good shape for, and it's a week after my last hard VO2 max workout. It's going to be, it's going to be like 12 workouts in 2.5 weeks and a couple double days. And you know what? I don't know if I'm going to be recovered, but fuck it. Why not? Let's try it.
oh no.
Yeah. Always leave yourself enough runway afterwards is the recommendation.
You're going to have a bad time.
Yes. And it's unfortunate with VO2 max stuff because the intensity is the stimulus. Like, you don't have to add time and zone. You don't have to go to like a 40 minutes worth of max efforts in a day. Like, that's like a,
oh no,
that would be a hard one.
That sounds so hard.
That's like a
eight
race
by fives, time. 8x5,
8x5. But I would give somebody that over the course of like 6 or 8 hours.
Yeah. 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 Not in like an hour and a half after work.
No, that sounds like death. Absolute death. No,
that's what I was thinking. I was thinking like, oh my God, imagine coming home from work and being like, this afternoon, hour and a half, 8x5. Here we go. Like 20 minute warm up.
Oh God. I mean, I'm sure people have done that, but they would probably be doing it submaximally. So it doesn't really get that hard until the last, like probably 3 to 4 would be my guess. Hopefully if you've got it targeted right. And you know, what's funny is that's also not the only way to raise VO2 max. Like one of our coaches is working on some interesting stuff on different VO2 max protocols, and they're partly good, but they're also partly not. And so kind of like this basic VO2 max block is kind of what I do prefer to do when I get the chance. Doesn't guarantee anything, doesn't guarantee improvements, but typically if you are ready for it and you're well prepared and you've got enough runway on the other side to recover, it tends to be a good to at least try. Like I said, no guarantees.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point too, but like you said, with like mixing the blocks, and if you maybe you are, like you said, you have never done a full dedicated VO2 max block, you can kind of titrate it in if you're doing sweet spot the mm-hmm. other days, and then have one hard VO2 max day, like, okay, yeah, no, I can do this, I can get used to this, and whatever boiling a frog analogy or whatever it is, right?
And so if you want to fold it in gradually, that's fine too, but I think the larger point is that there's no wrong way to, I mean, there is kind of a quote unquote wrong way, but there's also not a wrong way to periodize like VO2 max and FTP training. I mean, yeah. you can mix them all together, but as long as you're getting the recovery and you are getting out what you want to get out of the workouts, you didn't do it wrong. And I'm not somebody to sit here and say you did it wrong because you didn't do it the way I prefer to do it. So what?
Yeah. And like you said, if you're getting out, like obviously in a more controlled setting, if you are worried about this one specific attribute, VO2 max, yeah, you only do VO2 max work, especially like in a study, because it's easier to measure. But, you know, I'm sure you could probably set up a study, design a study where you had some people do VO2 max and FTP, some people just do VO2 max, blah, blah, blah. You could compare them, but no one's probably going to run that study. And, but that doesn't mean it's not valid, right? Just because something doesn't necessarily exist in the literature doesn't mean it like doesn't exist at all.
Yeah, true. So let's talk real quick about FTP training too, because there's been, I think there's still a pervasive rumor. And this is just what I hear and what I read on forums when people send me links and stuff, is that doing FTP training is not necessarily going to raise your FTP. And I think that might be hard to hear for a lot of people, or it might be one of those things where you go, oh, yeah, I don't make sense. Because I swear to God, like when I started training, I think we had talked about this in the 500K episode where we roasted my old plans. I had an old coach where he was like, he basically said, if you do a whole winter of FTP training, you're going to get your FTP up to 400 watts. And me and my friend were like, why don't we? Jeez, that sounds awesome.
Sign me up, yeah.
Because it doesn't work like that. And it takes years to make improvements like to that degree, especially if you're, you know, at like 200, what, 60 watt FTP like I was at the time. I think my highest ever was 300. So yeah, sign me up. That would be awesome. So here's the thing about FTP training. So it's not necessarily going to raise FTP, but it will early on. And a lot of the noob gains that we get from pretty much all aerobic training are plasma volume based. And we're going to look at a couple studies at some point in the Wostok series where we look at that, because I was waiting for something to happen on the high intensity side of things. And it's finally come out. Somebody's finally done the, like noob gains for high intensity stuff is like plasma volume, blah, blah, blah. Like we've known about for a long time with endurance training and, you know, VO2 max and all that kind of stuff. Like I think we had, I think it was the determinants of performance, the Coyle and Coggin paper, where they reinfused saline solution after people had detrained and got back most of their VO2 max.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, really, really cool study. And so that's really the driver of the noob gains, which is why you don't have to go out and hammer all the time to get those improvements. You can just spin. You can just go easy. You can just, you know, go out and ride endurance pace until the power stops going up. It's pretty awesome. So FTP also, like I said, doesn't need to be done in a block. If you're mixing up the block, one of the things that would actually become a difficulty is that if your FTP is actually going up while you're doing simultaneous FTP and VO2 max training, you're going to really have to be clued into your RPE and how the power feels, because, I've had a lot of clients like this where they'll say, this is feeling really easy. And so I decided to do more power for my efforts, and that felt more like FTP should. And that's one of those things that's always a good thing. But if you pass failure workouts, you're like, well, 4x10 FTP, like I can barely squeak through this workout. I'm going to be breathing through my asshole by the end of it. That's not your FTP.
Oh, man. Yeah. Just like sliding across Mark Cavendish crashing in the Giro, sliding across the finish line. Hey, I got fourth. You're like, oh.
But at what cost? Yeah, technically he got fourth, but he wasn't technically racing his bike across the line. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Although it's great to crash in the rain because you don't get better. Cut up.
Yeah.
You just slide. It's like a slip and slide.
Yeah, so much better.
Yeah, it's hydroplaning down the road. Anyway, so that's the FTP thing, where typically, and I think we've kind of talked about this before, I forget, but if you, one of the things I also like to see before I have somebody do a dedicated VO2max block is I like to see, you know, pretty high volume, generally compared to what somebody's been doing. And I also like to see somebody's TTE at FTP going out to like 55, 60 minutes or more. Because typically, in my experience, that is a really good setup to have an immediate FTP boost after a VO2max block. Again, like I said, not always a guarantee, but it seems to be a really, really good you know, prerequisite if that's what you want to get out of your FTP block. So does all that make sense? Did we cover? I think we covered a lot of good stuff, but we got some. Kyle, do you have any thoughts before we get into listener questions?
Yeah, I think too, just when you're structuring this, I think kind of like you said, that there are, you know, general guidelines, but a lot of this, it sounds like we keep saying this all the time, but a lot of it kind of came back to, oh, like, you know, be honest with yourself about how you're feeling. Like if that was too much, or if that FTP workout, that VO2max workout was too much, if that wasn't enough recovery, like, don't kid yourself, right? Like it's always going to be much harder. Like if you think, oh, it'll be fine, I'll just do it, you know. But if you dig yourself in such a great hole that you have to spend a month, 2 months, whatever, coming out of it, like, was it worth it? Was it worth that extra like week that you thought, oh yeah, this week will be fine, I'll just like grit my teeth and push through it? Like, but if it costs you like a month, 2 months, a summer or whatever of racing really crappy because you're just super beat up. You know, yeah, okay. If you never get super close, you know that you could be training a little bit harder and maybe you're leaving gains on the table or whatever, but like that doesn't mean you should aim for just barely surviving every block.
Yes, it's not like I'm going to go from a 200 watt FTP to a 400 watt FTP in this like 8 week period or die trying, like, cuz you will die trying.
Yeah. Like you know, it sounds nice that you can. Yeah, you should be pushing yourself hard, and you should, but it shouldn't be like, oh my God, I'm like a shell of a human being at work for a week, right? Like, yeah. if you're at that point where you like can't function in your daily life, like, yeah, maybe you have been doing a little bit too much.
Yeah, and you know, it may sound like glorious suffering if, you know, when I'm talking about, you know, like having a couple weeks to really fully realize the benefits of a VO2max block, but here's the thing is that you should be able to tell in block, like where intervals of the same duration are probably going up in power. Even if it's by a handful of watts, you know, across the board, or consistency is getting better. Like these are good things. But when you are, you know, a week or two outside of that block, you should at least see some improvements. Like it's not like, oh, I see zero improvements and I'm just hoping something else is here where I'm going to see them in a couple months, because that's a long feedback loop. No, you should probably be seeing at least a couple watts of FTP on the other side of it, like 5 or 10, like at minimum. And that's usually what I see when somebody's kind of on lower volume, something like that. But, you know, when we got somebody riding 20, 30 hours a week and they just did a hard VO2max block, I don't think I've yet seen somebody not gain like at least 15 watts out of the gate and then grab another 10 or 15 over the next couple of weeks. If they don't grab it all like immediately. So
yeah, I think that's a good benchmark too. Cause I think sometimes you say this to people like, oh, you should see it. But like, you know, you've been spending 20 hours a week staring at your Garmin. you can think you see a lot of things in that 3 second average as it goes up and down, right? Like it's like reading the matrix code. You start to be able to see deeper into the
it's like one of those magic numbers. Eyes that's not really a magic eye.
Yeah.
I'm seeing stuff in the numbers, man. Like that Always Sunny meme.
Yeah. The Pepe Silvia, yeah, the like conspiracy theory. Yeah. It's great.
I mean, because really, like, what we're looking for is improved performance. And I've done and like this year alone, at least 5 consultations of people where they've asked either directly or indirectly, has my training been effective, like in some way that I cannot see? Because like the power's not going up, not feeling stronger, is something getting better? And the answer is always, if your performance isn't improving and it's not because you're not resting, like, then the answer is no. Like if, cause some of the time, yeah, it's like you need a rest and then you'll see these improvements. Then people rest and they go, wow, that was great. otherwise, if you've been like doing everything right, you're not seeing it, then, you know, sometimes there's something fundamental missing or need to change your focus or something, or like, you know, a lot of the time I think people's perception of the mechanism of adaptation, is also different too. Because again, if you try to big brain it, and we'll talk about big braining some of the stuff in the adaptation series coming up, you could really go weird. Kyle, we're going to do some interesting thought experiments. I actually just put in our notes for the calcium episode. I can't wait to hear what you come up with. So So keep it simple is really a good principle. Like if you think something should be improving, you should see improvement. And it doesn't have to be any kind of fancy stuff. Look for performance. All right. Listener question number one is 4 hours in zone 2 and then a maximal power output from 5 to 7 minutes useful? I would say this will give you a really good indicator of your 5 to 7 minute power after 4 hours of zone 2.
And if that may be race specific for you, I don't know, you know, like, yeah.
So here's the thing is, I think this is kind of getting at, is it better, like where on a ride can you do intervals? And the answer is, unless you've got something very specific in mind, anywhere, really anywhere. I think in our FTP episode from forever ago, was that like Wostock, like 14 or something like that, 15? I think I discussed something like you could do like one FTP interval per hour. So if you do a 4-hour ride, you do a 15-minute effort every hour. That's an awesome ride. You don't have to block them up into like 5-minute rests. You don't have to do them at the start. You don't have to do them at the end. If you could do them throughout, it's fine. Or if you want to do them at the end or the start, it also doesn't matter. But I would say if you are somebody who cannot do high-quality efforts throughout a ride, if you are really looking to get the most out of the intervals themselves, do them early. So if you're going to do VO2 max efforts on a 5-hour ride and it's like, well, I can do them at the end, but I can't really push that hard because I'm kind of tired. Do them at the start. You'll get the most out of it. Then rest, recover, eat, drink, and then you can just cruise easy. It's that easy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Or like, yeah, like do some hard workout, some harder intervals, and then be like, meet up with some friends for a coffee ride and keep riding, hang out, you know?
Yeah. Let's see. If you breathe like a fish out of water at X watts, does it make a difference to go even harder? So here's the thing about the breathing and hitting VO2 max and all that kind of stuff. Like if we're looking in normal like VO2 max type interval ranges. So I would say 2 to 5 or 6 minutes is like typical. I would say probably out to 8 minutes would be the very long end of what I would probably give somebody for just raising VO2 max. It doesn't really matter as long as the interval is basically maximal. But for the most part, if you're like going really hard for 2 to 6 minutes, you're not doing it wrong. So if you go harder, just even looking at the critical power W prime model, like you will just make the interval shorter, right?
Yeah. Within reason, right? You know, not, oh, I could squeak out, I'm at 300 watts, I could squeak it out to 450, but then I'm going to like crash and burn immediately, you know?
Yeah.
Like that might be one of those things where maybe they're trying to over-optimize, like the amount of brain power and planning and focus it would take to be like, oh, I'm at 320, but I think I could get to like 335 and like maybe hold on to for the same amount of time. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
You're breathing hard. You're working hard. It feels hard. You know, your heart rate's high. It's great.
Yes. Yeah. It's pretty simple. It's good. Off season for a long course triathlete, huge drop of FTP, what to aim for? I'm not entirely sure what this question is asking, but I want to address off-season FTP. I think a lot of people are hesitant to let their fitness go away. A lot of people.
Yeah.
Guess what? This is good. It's called rest. You need it. Let the fitness go away. Don't fucking hammer like all year round just because you're terrified of losing like 10, 15 watts off your FTP, because you know what's going to happen is you are going to overtrain, or you're at least not going to be fresh enough in order to improve from where you've been. Taking a rest is one of the best indicators that when you start training hard again, you will be able to get beyond where you had been.
Yeah. And I think just getting comfortable with the idea that like, oh, the number might be going down, but it's not lost forever, right? It's not like you're setting a pile of money on fire or something, like you're never going to see it again.
Yeah.
And I understand this too. Like, you know, it's great when you see big numbers come out of the computer and you get sad when the numbers aren't as big, but it is a process. It's not, if you could stay in amazing shape the whole year round, like that'd be great, but it's just not. Even people who are pros, professionals, but they don't do anything else, don't do this, right? Like they, if you could, it'd be great, but even if this is your full-time job, you can't do it. So
after a hard season, it's like, you mean I don't have to think about, like, you know, packing my bike up? I don't have to think about what I'm eating. I don't have to think about, you know, going hard again. I'm not nervous for any tests or like, you know, team politics or, you know, Peloton politics, whatever it is. Like, it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think too, like probably because, you know, pros aren't, a lot of them are not super forthcoming with numbers and stuff. And you don't know how exactly what does it mean to get out of shape in the off season? You know, it can be, you don't have, people aren't publishing it like, oh yeah, I lost 20 watts and that was fine, but I was just, you know, having a rest, enjoying, you know, doing cross country rides or something instead and just relaxing.
Yeah.
But they don't publish it. So.
Yeah. But I mean, that kind of goes back to that, you know, that, you know, plasma volume loss thing. It's like most of my cyclists, when they start riding again after a season break, it doesn't take that long before they're basically right back to where they were. So
yeah,
a couple months and it's like, oh, let's do an FTP test. Oh, look at that. Either a PR or it's within 10 watts or it's the same as before. It's not a huge amount of movement. And if you are fighting tooth and nail to like hang on to a couple watts, I mean, well, anyway, moving on. FTP at 260, but can do 4x5 minutes at 350 watts at a 10 out of 10 RPE. Is my FTP low compared to VO2 power? Yes, but this could also be from a very large anaerobic capacity.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds like something I could have done back in the day.
Like, me too. Like you and me are actually great examples of exactly this. Like, Kyle, what was your highest FTP and what was your best ever 5 minutes at that FTP?
I think my best FTP was probably, you know, 300 watts, maybe 305 or something, you know, like, no, it was 300 watts, whatever. You know, I wasn't about to ride at 300 watts for, you know, more than 45 minutes or something like that. But, I think my best ever 5 minute power at that was like 440, 445, something like that. Yeah. You know, like 100, like full on 150%, where you're like, well, that's weird.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And mine was 430 watts for 5 minutes. And at the time, my FTP was about 270, 280. like a typical like 4 or 5 by 5 minute like interval day for me, my 5 minute efforts would, like, I think the best one I ever did, they were all at like between 370 and 390, if I recall correctly, I have to go back. It might be a handful of watts lower, but like most of them were like, yeah, like between 340 to 370 was like a pretty typical range for me for like four or five by 5 minutes. And that was at like a 9 out of 10 RPE for most of them. 9.5.
Yeah. Yeah. People be like, oh yeah, you can do VO2 max work at like 110%. I remember trying that and being like, yeah. This is easy.
Yeah. I remember I once got given intervals where it was like, go out and do 2 minute efforts at your like access road power, which is like 5 minute power. And I was like, yeah, but I'm breathing through my nose. Like, I don't see what is this doing? The answer was not much. It was actually keeping me fresh is what it was. Because the program that I was being given at the time didn't have a lot of rest incorporated into it. And so it was really just not, it was like a workout where you go out and you kind of ride, but also it's not that fatiguing because it's not really doing much.
It's like an opener workout.
Yeah. Yeah. It was basically like a medium day where it's like not a lot of fatigue gathered, but also like not a lot of adaptation gathered. It's fine. And the logic was like, you will have your full power on race day. I'm like, yeah, because I'm like fresh as a daisy. Like but I want to make it better. I don't just want to like tread the same ground. Anyway, so the answer is yes. It's probably a combination of anaerobic capacity and like an FTP relatively low relative to VO2 max. And this might be like, because in the the typical range is somewhere like, what's the low end that we've ever seen? It's like 55, 60%, and the high end is like 88. 90%, something like that.
Yeah.
So, and so anything over FTP is in your anaerobic capacity, including that headroom, like for your VO2 max, relative to FTP. So, it's fine. It's not like a good thing. It's not like a bad thing. It's like, you know that about yourself. Cool. Maybe relative to your other competitors, you know, you've got a little better 5 minute or something like that. That's pretty much what it comes down to. Can you TLDR about high cadence and heart pump preload at VO2 max? So yeah, this was one of the things that we went deep into with VO2 max because the whole series was really based around a bunch of papers that I had found that explained the Fick equation in a lot of cool ways and looking at, you know, hemodynamics and, you know, capillaries and blah, 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 heart stroke and all that. And kind of we teased out like what is the root like driver of VO2 max, and the answer was stroke volume, like heart stroke volume.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I found in my research is that a lot of people tend to have a like untrained people have a stroke volume peak that is like far below their heart rate max. So like stroke volume will increase to, I don't know, like 70, 80 milliliters a stroke or something like that, or whatever it is. I forget exactly what the range is. But that will plateau at like 70% heart rate max for like an untrained person. And for a very well-trained person, it won't plateau. Like heart stroke volume will go up until you hit heart rate max. And so if we are working at these high diastolic filling pressures when we are at VO2 max, and that potentially seems to be a mechanism of adaptation of growing the heart, then by raising your cadence, you increase what's called the muscle pump. So one of the ways that we return blood to the heart, it's not just the heart itself pumping, because that means the heart has to work harder. Basically, it would get like thicker, like a bicep, like doing a lot of bicep curls, like a bodybuilder. And that is one of the adaptations that happens when you are like actually a bodybuilder or a power lifter, is your heart gets thicker, but the stroke volume doesn't really increase. So the heart muscle gets used to pushing against all of that peripheral resistance when you are doing that lifting. When you are, sorry, this is not really a TLDR. it's a little long. But so when you raise your cadence doing VO2 max efforts, not only are you reducing the muscular load and the muscular fatigue that's associated with that kind of stuff, but you are increasing the rate at which you are squeezing your muscles to return blood to the heart. And that is one of the big mechanisms. That's the heart pump, the muscle pump mechanism for, you know, venous return to the heart. And so when you raise your cadence and you're at VO2 max, one of the cool things that you will find is that if you are actually at your heart stroke max, you will see your maximum heart rate drop in the interval. So like if you are like 3/4 of the way through a 4-minute interval, you're at minute 3, your heart stroke volume or your heart rate is kind of plateaued and you're breathing really, really hard and you're at like 100, 110 RPM, something like that. Change your cadence to like 80 or 90. You will watch your heart rate go up, most likely. And I've seen this so many times where like the heart rate will go up and down relative to the cadence because of whether or not you are increasing the venous return and increasing the diastolic filling pressures volume. So if that is indeed the mechanism behind raising stroke volume, we can increase that the effectiveness by increasing the cadence. It's hopefully that was said simply enough. I don't know if it was.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought that was a cool fact, like that. Yeah. Your body has developed these ways to not just use the heart to help get the blood back to your heart, but your whole body is helping along.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So let's see. VO2 max estimates equal junk science. Is spirometry the only true way? Yes and no. Like we can get pretty close, but even spirometry has error associated with it. Like you can get a bad test for sure. But the question is, what would you do with it?
Brag to my internet friends?
Like you can't assign training based on VO2 max. Can you?
I mean, if you could, it would be cool if you could, you know, if you got it often enough to like track progress or something. What does it help you in your day to day?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. It's like it's one of those things where you could use it to track progress, but you have to keep going back to the lab and that gets expensive. And so if you just do basic tests, like 3 to 5 minutes or like 20 to 30 minutes, something like that, if those are improving, your VO2 max is improving. You don't need to go to a lab to see that. But you also have to not be too tired to test well. Or you also have to be able to test well. Some people test terribly. So you've got to do other stuff to figure it out. So let's see. Next question is, how do we really know if the VO2 blocks helped raise FTP ceiling or not? Your FTP goes up. It's pretty simple. I wish there were a more complicated answer, but it is that simple. If fatigued and FTP intervals are done at 10 to 15 watts lower than usual, is it still worthwhile for FTP intervals? It depends on the duration. And this is actually one of the benefits of Sweet Spot, is if you are doing FTP work and FTP is just a little too not quite there, like the RP is a little higher than you would want it, and you're like, man, I got to do 3x20 today, and I don't think I can do more than 2x20. If you think you can do a good duration sweet spot workout, if you're like, okay, my sweet spot workout, it's like 80, 90 minutes, and I think I can do that today, FTP is a little hard, do that. But when you are looking at like a 10-watt delta, it's not a huge difference, honestly. Like if you're working at 300 watts and you're doing 3x20, and instead you do it at 290 watts, it's fine. It's fine.
On my pass-fail scale, it's a fail.
Well, one of the other things to note about FTP itself is it's not like one number. It's a range. It's a range of numbers. And in my estimate, it's 10 watts wide. And so if you are working at the top of this range, then you are probably going to accumulate a little extra fatigue that you don't need, which is why I usually have people do FTP work like either by feel or like a couple watts lower than I think they need to, like 5 to 10. Because it's fine. There's you don't get extra bonus adaptation for like those extra couple watts.
Yeah.
Would a VO2 max block increase FTP if another FTP block could as well? The answer is yes. That sounds like noob gains. Congratulations. like we said earlier, if pretty much anything raises your FTP, it's pretty much increasing plasma volume, and that would be raising VO2 max from noob gains, and that's awesome. It's a great place to be. It means you can just do whatever you want, and it's a good place to be because it means you can just go do something fun instead of like doing a structured workout. I mean, unless a structured workout's fun, in which case do that. But yeah, it's the same difference.
I wish I had noob gains forever. Just exist in that linear, like very linear progression. I did one workout and I got better. I did another workout and I got better. Like, yeah.
There are a handful of people out there, a handful, where doing endurance riding and FTP training seems to always be effective to raise FTP. And they are genetic freaks in the good way, and they are extremely, extremely lucky that they get to do that. So congratulations to them. I'm coaching just one of them on my entire roster, just one. Let's see. What are signs of overreaching in an endurance block? No longer progressing time and zone, restless sleep. An endurance block, overreaching would be you're tired and hungry. Like, time and zone should not exist if you're just riding endurance pace. It should just be riding. It's the total time riding.
Time and zone is 97% of the ride time.
Yes. So riding at endurance pace is a pretty wide range. And as long as it feels easy, but you're still pedaling, it's good. Like, it's harder than recovery pace, but it's not like hard. It should still feel easy. So just total volume. That's all you need. And make sure you're eating enough on the bike, especially. What's the least amount of time you would try between VO2 max blocks if TTE says you are ready again? Ooh, that's tough. Kyle, you want to take a stab at it while I chew on this for a sec?
I mean,
I know it's tough. Here's the reason I don't have a great answer for this. It's because usually most people have more stuff going on where we don't have infinite time to just do FTP and VO2 max and endurance and whatever forever. And here's the thing is that I don't think that would necessarily be good. Because, like, let's say you do a 3-week VO2 max block, and then you do 2 3-week, with a rest week in between FTP blocks. Things are going well. Great. You're back up to getting ready for VO2 max. Usually that's a rarity. The last time that happened for a coaching client for me was in 2020, where there were no races, nothing was happening. I was like, oh, well, it's time for whatever. And it didn't go well. It really didn't. It was time for a rest or tapering a little bit, doing some race specific stuff, even though there was no racing, that would have been what we normally would have done. And we didn't get to do it. And so, I don't really know the answer. I would say like, here's another way to look at it. What's the most number of VO2 max blocks that you could do in a year effectively? My reasonable guess is 1 to 2. I'd say at a big stretch might be 3, but that would be a big stretch. You'd have to come in January, do some stuff, rest, prep again, do another block, rest, prep again, do another, maybe. I haven't even done it, which is why I don't really know the answer. So yeah.
Yeah. I was gonna say, if you structured your whole year around just doing VO2 max blocks, sure, you could do 4 of them or something, but if that was the only thing you'd like without racing, right? Like, you have all these other things to do. Like you said, if you're like, oh, hypothetically, if I was only concerned about doing VO2 max workouts, if those were my A events, how many could I do?
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing is you could do VO2 max the whole year if you wanted to. Doesn't mean it's going to be the most effective, but you could. So yeah, I, if anybody out there has like basically no events and they're just kind of, you know, trying this stuff all year round, let me know. Cause I would be curious about what you feel works and what's effective and what seems to be too much. I really would be. Let's see. If I can hold my old FTP for 3 hours, it's not FTP anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
3 hours.
I mean,
3 hours.
It's your old FTP for a reason. The longest I've ever seen anybody hold FTP is like 84 minutes. Yeah, 84 minutes.
3 hours.
I'm going to let Kyle, I'm just letting you marinate in this. What?
Is that like, you know, I just, yeah, the great. Yeah.
What percentage of riders do you think are training with an accurate FTP? I think we'd have to define accurate, right? Like within 10 watts? See, I don't even know. I don't have enough data to answer this question. For empirical cycling clients, 100% final answer. That's as far as I can go. I can't extrapolate any further than the people whose data I have. That's it.
Yeah, hard to say.
Yeah. What's reasonable for adding time to TTE, like workout to workout or week to week? Here's the thing about this is if you are riding more endurance, if you're doing more volume, it's easier to add a lot more time at once. If you are on low volume, it's more difficult to add time. This is just in my experience. I'm sure that there are exceptions out there, but typically my estimate is if you're riding enough, adding maybe 5 or 10 minutes per week or two is probably reasonable. Otherwise you might be lucky to get two to five per week. But here's the thing is if you are getting enough rest and you want to try to see how much time you can add, decide what like a whatever RPE feels like. Call it a 7 or an 8 or a 9. Like on a fatigue scale, not on a, you know, 0 to whatever watts scale. And like ballpark it to like an 8 out of 10. And this is where I would say, this is where you stare at your computer and you've got to focus really hard to keep the power up. Go 5 minutes into that range and then stop intervals and see what time you did. And the next time you go out and do intervals, see if you can improve that by a couple minutes before you get to that point. But the difficult part with this is that you have to be really conscious of your RPE. Because if you are hammering this stuff too hard and you're like, oh, this feels fine, and it's really not fine, I mean, that's going to suck. Don't do that. So, yeah. So if you're game for that kind of stuff, go try it and see what you can add. But there's not a right or a wrong answer. That's honestly as specific as I could possibly get. Sorry.
Yeah. I was thinking that like a slide that Tim made about, a progression of adding a little bit of time, you know.
Oh, for like sweet spot workouts or something like that? Or
yeah,
FTP?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's also like not a bad way to look at it. Cause I think within like 7 or 8 workouts, he's got people at like an hour or of FTP or 90 minutes of SST or something like that. But that's not necessarily a rule.
Right. No. It's just like a framework and it's somewhere to start. And if it's like, if you think like, oh, this isn't enough, you could try more.
Yes.
You're like, oh, this is too much. Slow down.
Yeah. next question. Any way to know what your theoretical max FTP could be for a given VO2 max and weight? No.
All of it? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, that's one of the things that I tell people, especially people who are talented and want to make XYZ improvements. I'll say, okay, we can use this as a guidepost, but I cannot guarantee that we'll get there. A lot of the time we do. But sometimes we don't. And I wish I had an oracle. If I could predict this kind of thing, I would be a rich man indeed. And I would give away every secret I have for free because I made it. But I would give people rides in my Lamborghini. I'm just kidding. I'm a Ferrari guy. I'm also not a Ferrari guy. Wait, yes, I am. I have a Ferrari collection. What am I talking about? I forgot the April Fool's episode. So, yeah, there's no way to know. You have to do the highest quality training you can. And when it stops, who knows? Yeah, you've just got to see what you can get out. Some people respond very quickly and very in very large amounts to minimal training. And there are also people who kind of...
Screw those people.
Yeah. There are people who also can just progress slow and steady for years. And I've got clients on both sides. And most of them are in the slow and steady for years kind of side of things. So, yeah. Let's see. If FTP is just spicy endurance, what the hell is VO2 max? I guess it's like a ghost pepper or something, like a scotch bonnet, I guess. Yeah, but actually here's the thing about, cause I said FTP is spicy endurance and it kind of is, but also it's kind of not, cause anybody would tell you that FTP training feels different from endurance training. But they make a lot of the same adaptations, right? So they're similar but different. It's like apples and oranges. Like they're fruit. One of them's a little different, but it's still fruit. And it's still got vitamins and fiber and potassium and all that kind of whatever. So, yeah, don't read into the metaphors too much, folks. It's it's not healthy. That's something I would do.
Yeah, you got to know when they start and stop, when they're effective and not effective.
Yeah. 30 seconds anaerobic into 15-15s, total 4 minutes 30 on. Breathing out my ass, is this training VO2 max? We actually brought this up earlier about breathing. For intermittent intervals, I tend to find that breathing is a less good indicator of being at VO2 max. I don't have any evidence for this other than it seems to be easy to breathe hard doing these efforts while not improving your VO2 max. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. And I think, and we talked about this a little bit before in another episode, like if you're doing them for anaerobic capacity versus doing them for VO2 max, like, is, you know, the anaerobic capacity ones, you're definitely breathing super, super duper hard because you're just gassed. Like mm-hmm. totally. Your body's like, what are you doing? Like trying to recover.
Yeah.
And even though that feels hard, your breathing is uncontrolled and but it's not, not necessarily the same.
Yeah. And like, here's the thing is I would, if we're looking at, diastolic filling pressures, and volume as a driver of adaptation, and we know that well-trained athletes don't get to those peak filling pressures until they're at heart rate max. I would want to see more time at very high heart rates for this kind of work. And that can be very difficult to achieve sometimes. Whereas in steady state intervals, it seems to be much easier to get. So let's see. Next question is, if an athlete has a setback or setbacks, sorry for your troubles, friend, would you revisit an FTP or VO2 block to sharpen or stick to the original plan? Okay, that's a tough one because other than it depends. All right, sorry, had to get out of the way. But I would say assess first. Because depending on the nature of the setback, like if you had COVID, I am not sending you into a VO2 max block afterwards. No fucking way. If you've got a head cold, maybe. If you've got a broken collarbone, probably not.
Ouch.
Yeah. It depends on how long you were out too. Because if you were out for like 3 weeks and you did like nothing, chances are you've got a fair bit of detraining and you're not going to have, a very high VO2 max to begin with. Like, so you're going to have somewhat low detrained plasma volume, especially if you're a little older. People in their 20s seem to just maintain it. Ugh, lucky bastards. I wish I were 20 again. But I would probably do like a week or two of just kind of do like a week of basic base training, quote unquote base training, just easy endurance riding, building volume. Week two might add some tempo and sweet spot kind of work. And then if you're feeling really good at that point and everything's looking normal for you, then assess about where am I now and what's my next goal and fill in between. So there's certainly, yeah, like we said before, there's not a wrong way to do it. But there's also wrong ways to do it. What fractional utilization would you suggest for an XCM rider? As high as you can get it, friend. As high as you can get it.
For any endurance sport, insert your favorite one. Like,
outdoor VO2 max reps are 20 watts higher than indoor. Better adaptations? Not necessarily. I see this sometimes too, but I actually don't find that there's much of a difference if people do the VO2 max indoors or outdoors, even if outdoors has higher power. Because usually when you're generating a lot of heat over threshold, this can keep the body kind of shutting down the power output, like just because you don't want to cook your organs. So when you're outside and you're moving, you get a lot more cooling. And so, but I don't see that there's any real difference in the effects as long as you're doing them the same way. If you're thinking about it like just targeting power, that may have an effect, but also it may not. So probably not. I don't think there's much difference.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I liked doing them indoors just because you could like stop pedaling and not have to worry about steering at the end, you know, at the end of an interval. You can like, sometimes you're like, if you're on a hill or something, right? First of all, if you're on a hill and it's not over after your interval's over, you're like, well, do I just stop, you know, or something? Yeah. Or you're like, oh, I have to worry about steering or whatever if you're, you know, in a steep section or something like that. It's just sometimes it's nice if it's more controlled.
Yeah. Yeah. Picking the right terrain if you're outdoors makes a difference, especially if like it's really up and down, and it's hard to control the cadence. If that's something that you're targeting, definitely indoors is an easier way to do it. I've got a lot of clients who will like be indoors when it's nice out doing VO2 max efforts, and then they'll finish the efforts, then go outside and go, okay, yeah, that's done. It's time to go ride for real. Guess the FTP if a rider did two sets of 10 reps at 30-30s at 425 watts. The answer is you cannot.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're really anaerobic, you can have, you know, much lower than if you're, I don't know, Brad Wiggins.
Yeah. I would want to say like, how hard is it? Like, is this a max effort? Is it sub max? What's the heart rate? What's the breathing? Like, what's the RPE? Could you do more of them? Or is this a one-off? There's no way to tell. For ultra distance racing, how much of my training should focus on raising FTP? I would say you definitely have to some degree, because here's the thing about FTP and ultra racing, because ultra racing mostly takes place below like LT1, VT1, like that, you know, it mostly takes place at pretty low intensity. And if you want to raise that intensity, you can do it to a certain degree. And the highest I've ever seen it relative to FTP is probably 85%. So if you want to raise that pace even higher, like let's say your FTP is 300 watts and you're like, man, I wish I could just hold 300 watts for 24 hours, but I can't because I can only hold it for, you know, 65 minutes or something like that. Yeah, you've got to raise your FTP. So with the ultra racers that we train, because I don't have any ultra racers on my roster anymore, but our coaches sure do. And one of the things that they say is that this is something that they like to have for the off season, because in season, especially if you're racing a lot, some ultra racers do race a whole lot, there's no way that you can actually train in season to raise your FTP. Like, it's just not going to happen. So it's an out of season thing. And so that's when you would want to focus on raising that after you've recovered from your season, and then kind of, you know, getting into your ultra specific stuff. So that's probably not a bad way to do it. Let's see. Physiologically, why can't you keep repeating VO2 max blocks more than 4 or 5 weeks? I usually don't want somebody to go past like three.
I mean, you can. It's just you'd be so tired that, like, you're just not doing good work. Like if you're not recovering from your last week, last workout, whatever, in time before your next one to do them quality, then your next one is just effectively junk volume, right? Like, you're just...
Yeah, it's not
making
even
yourself tired.
Well,
and like,
I would say not even junk volume. It's like junk intensity.
Yeah.
Because you are, if you do it hard enough, and here's the thing, is like, if you are seeing performance improvements as you go and you want to keep going and you feel like you've got the capacity for it and you've got plenty of runway to recover, go ahead. I'm not going to tell you not to, but when people are giving me money to train them, I always like to go a little bit conservative. Like, I think maybe we can get another couple percent out, but the risk and the reward, the ratio is not right. The risks are too high. The rewards are too low. This has been a very successful block so far. It's time to pull the ripcord. We don't have to squeeze out every last little bit.
Yeah, because if you overshoot and then you're overtrained and then you spend a month riding at zone one, like, because you can't do anything. Like, what did that get you, right? Like,
or zone zero on the couch.
Yes. you tried too much. And so now, instead of being like that extra whatever, you eke out an extra 1% or something by making your block longer than it has to be. Mm-hmm. Now you've traded that for a bunch of downtime.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you want to maximize the amount of time that you want to maximize the amount of time that you can do quality work.
Yeah.
And so that risk there, yeah.
Just, well, that's one of the things that I noticed about that. Did you see that Twitter thread with Matteo Jorgensen?
No.
He was talking about basically how he had, been training hard and recovering and investing in himself, and he's having a good spring, et cetera, et cetera. And that's all well and good. But the part that caught my eye, and I discussed this with some friends, is he said that, like, was it last year or the year before? Like, some spring, he had buried himself so hard, he didn't really recover until, like, December. He was like, you can bury yourself as hard as you want, I think was the implication, as long as you fully recover from it. And my thought is that if it really takes you, like, 6 months to recover, you might have gone too hard. You might have gone a little deep. Because I have not really pushed anybody that hard where it takes 6 months to recover to see any benefits. It's like... I mean, yeah.
It's next year, basically, right? You missed all the racing.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever had anybody take more than, like, if they get really, really tired, because they're either riding too much or, like, riding too hard or for their endurance pace or, like, doing too many group rides on top of whatever, even under my protest, I've never seen anybody take more than, like, 4 to 6 weeks to really fully come back out of it. 6 months sounds like a lot, but... maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm missing something, but it doesn't seem necessary. But the lesson is that no matter how hard you have gone, you should fully recover before the next training phase. I think that part is well taken for sure. So yeah, even if it does take you 6 months, maybe you think, maybe I'm not going to do 6 months worth of damage again, but maybe I'll take now I know the limit of what I could have done some quality training or racing in between there instead. What's the best way for us normal folks to get our FTP result? I think he means improve FTP. I think Tim and I had talked about this, where a lot of people are actually volume limited on this stuff. My clients who are riding a lot, typically we are seeing improvements year to year. For a lot of people who don't get much more than 10, 12, 15 hours a week, improvements are slow if they're happening at all. And when they are happening, I'm very, very happy. But also a lot of the time, if you are kind of low volume and it's hard to move your FTP, try different training focus, try a little more overload with of course, a little extra recovery on the other side of it. But at the same time, sometimes you need to change your strategy around your season. Instead of trying to add more FTP, think, what other stuff can I do that's going to give me better results without raising my FTP? If it's like improving your sprint or improving your pack handling skills, like maybe do less training and go race more, improve your race craft. Maybe you work on your repeated efforts instead. Like, maybe you work on, I have a hard time with high cadence, work on that. Work on low cadence if you have a hard time with longer, steep stuff. Like, there's no wrong way to go about chasing improvements, because when you tie everything to FTP, like, yeah, sure, we put a lot of emphasis on it, but if you are, like, just an FTP rider and you can't do anything else, then, you know, there's only so far that you're going to get. And then instead of, you know, those aerobic improvements being low-hanging fruit, a lot of other stuff around it becomes low-hanging fruit instead. And that's the kind of stuff you need to start chasing. And maybe instead you need to freshen up, be fresh more in a season, like, you know, get ready to race and then go have a lot of good races. I wrote an article about this like years ago about what happens kind of when we think that we've hit the limit with somebody. And my answer was, you know, go get better results. Go, instead of peaking a couple times through a season, like, be at 95% through the whole season and go try to get more good results. That was my solution. So anyway, does that make sense? Did I just ramble too long?
No, I think that makes sense. You have to be realistic, and yeah, as you said before, like, volume is the is a key driver in aerobic and endurance adaptation. So yeah, that like we said, it's like a lot of things in life. When you have a lot of things to do, it's not that you couldn't get there. It's that you also just have a finite total amount of time. There are 24 hours in every day. And you know, unless you're getting paid to do this and this is all you do, there are other things, you know, that are just going to take up your time, and that's fine.
Yeah. All right. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you for all of the questions asked on my Instagram at Empirical Cycling up in the stories. And I'm looking forward to getting into the weekend AMAs when we are done recording this podcast. So thank you all for all of those submissions, and thank you all for the donations at empiricalcycling.com/donate. That really does keep the lights on. We've got a lot of hosting fees and yada, yada. So, and as soon as Kyle starts charging me a lot of money for each appearance, that'll help that. And we've got show notes up on the website. I'll probably link to a couple of the podcast episodes, the show notes up there that we talked about. If you have any coaching inquiries, empiricalcycling@gmail.com. We are taking on all clients, students, and professional athletes. We know you guys don't make a lot of money, so we are willing to negotiate our coaching rates for students and professional athletes. So if you're curious about that, please reach out. And otherwise, yeah, if you're just looking to hire a coach, also reach out. So we have just added a new coach. And I think she's going to be great. So if you want to, you know, get in on the ground floor with somebody at a reasonable rate, now's a good time to do it. So anyway, I think that's about it. So yeah, we'll see you all next time. Bye.